financial planning, and security can sometimes be seen as a moving target. The rules change constantly, and you need guidance to stay ahead of the market moves. This is the Labenthal Report with Michael Hartzman and Dominic Tavella. We'll break down the news, trends, and overall direction of the markets, telling you what may be coming next, investment opportunities, and what to avoid. Now, here are your hosts, Dominic Tavella and Michael Hartzman.
All right, I'm Michael Hartzman. Today is Tuesday, August 16th, 2022. I'm on, as always, with my partner, Dominic Tavella. How are you, Dominic?
Doing well, Mike. How about yourself?
I'm doing very well. Last week we were off, so we really haven't talked about the market very much in the last 2 weeks, Dominic. And the best thing I could say right now is that it's boring again. Just things seem to be kind of in a good place right now. The market's not making headlines. We're not hyperventilating about inflation. We kind of know where interest rates are. And in our world, you know, we say it all the time, boring is beautiful. And I don't know if it's going to last. But we're in a little bit of a respite right now, and I'll take it.
So a quick recap. The last time we were on, Mike, we were literally worried about what was that horrific inflation number going to be. And as horrific as it was, it actually was less horrific than the markets were expecting. Mm-hmm. And that was a very positive tell. And the markets have reacted really well with last week alone, the S&P, the Dow, the NASDAQ up 3% for the week. So people are feeling a little bit better, as you indicated. People are taking a deep breath and going, well, maybe it's not going to be so bad. And you know what? I'll take it right now, Mike. I'll take it.
Yeah, you know, not only for the week, I mean, quarter to date, which is basically July 1st till now, the S&P is up 13 and change. The NASDAQ, which is always the more volatile sector, is up 18 and a half.
From the bottom.
And we're just quarter to date, but yeah, 18 and a half from the bottom. And the S&P has basically made back half of the yearly losses. We were down 20% at one point, and now we're down a little less than 10. So you and I talked about this a lot. We both felt once we had a handle on inflation, once we had a handle on interest rates, the market hates uncertainty. We kind of both felt this is exactly what would happen. I think it just happened a month or two later than we thought it would.
Spot on, Mike. I could not have said it any better myself. We literally started the first part of the year with the markets worrying about runaway inflation. And that quickly shifted in June to, oh my God, we're going to have runaway recession. And both data points, the recession doesn't look like, if we get one, it's going to be that significant. And interest rates look like they may not have to go as high. Inflation is starting to roll over. So I don't think we're through the woods yet. I don't think we can sound the all clear, but clearly, whether it's us, clients, the markets, we're all feeling a little bit better today.
And it's also encouraging, Dominic, that we are in the dog days of summer. And what that means to, you know, regular investors who don't watch this all the time is the summer, the volume is normally a little lighter. And this is a perfect time for the market in years past to be susceptible to a bit of a sell-off if there's not much conviction. Right? It doesn't take much for the market to sell off. And the market has just been nice and steady, as I said, pretty much through the entire summer months so far.
Well, again, Mike, I think you're exactly right. A lot of people literally take off vacation time. Volume is low. Earnings season is almost done. So there's not a lot of noise out there to influence the market. So this is normally when you get a little bit of a pullback. And I think it's very probable that we will. Markets never go straight up. They never go straight down. It's usually ledges. So it wouldn't be surprising if we went a little bit lower over these next 4 to 6 weeks. But we have enough data points right now, earnings, economy, unemployment, that it may not be quite as bad as some people were predicting just 2 months ago.
And the other part of that, Dominic, is the other thing that the market was worried about pretty intensely, as you said, was a recession. And really the outlier of this whole thing is unemployment and how strong the labor market has been, which again, you know, passes out always prologue. But normally, if you're in the middle of a recession, people are losing their jobs in droves, and we're just not seeing that. It's the opposite
right now. Mike, I'm glad you brought it up. Last week's employment number showed 500,000 new jobs created. You normally don't see that in a recession, or if an employer thinks a recession is coming, they're not going to go out and hire 100 people. So we have seen some industries, particularly technology, slow down their hiring. And we've seen some layoffs, but you know, industries like hospitality, hotels, restaurants, they're still trying to recover. There's plenty of demand. So these are not the typical circumstances where you would see at least a deep recession. You might see a mild one, but nothing significant.
And I think the other part of it is, and we haven't really talked about this very much, maybe in months, for sure, weeks, you know, COVID's still out there. And I think we've reached the point of the pandemic. I think I saw a statistic the other day that 95% of the U.S. population at this point has been affected by it. And I think we're at the point now, Dominic, where people are just living with it. I mean, we talked a lot about people wanting to get on with their lives. I think we're past that point. I think people are getting on with their lives.
Again, Mike, spot on. I'm seeing it with our own clients, like, oh, and by the way, I got COVID. And you're like, you know, we used to think of that 2 years ago. Oh my God, you know, are you going to survive? Are you going to have to go to the hospital? You're going to go to an emergency room. Now it's like, oh yeah, you got the flu, you know? Right. And so I think we're all learning that. And hopefully if you've been vaccinated, if you've taken your booster shots, hopefully that makes it less severe. I'm not going to make a call here. I'll let everybody decide on their own what they want to do. But it just does seem that between people getting their shots and maybe people having gotten COVID and recovered, most of the population is in a state where they're somewhat protected.
Right. Which also means that most people, you know, if not all, have kind of gone back to work, and whether they're still working at home or going back to an office, which also leads us to, we haven't heard a lot about the supply chain issues, which was putting a tremendous lot of pressure on. So as I said, Dom, in the beginning, it just seems right now, for the first time in 6 or 7 months, we're just kind of in a quiet place. I don't know how long it's going to last, but I'm just enjoying it while we have it.
Yeah, Mike, we always stress because the clients stress. And looking at your statements, I understand it, right? It's normal. But a little quiet time is not a bad thing. Everybody takes a deep breath and looks at things a little bit calmly. And I'm stressing, I personally don't believe we're through this yet. I think there's still going to be some volatility through the end of the year. We have a really important election in November. We'll see that might drive the markets. So far, so good. And hopefully we get a little bit of a run into the end of the year, and maybe we close the year not bad place at all.
Yeah, we've been saying that all along, and I think that's entirely possible. And I think it's encouraging, as I said, that we've made half of it back. Dom, just to switch gears, when we started this podcast over a year and a half ago, the goal was to bring relative information to our clients and to our listeners. And, you know, and every now and again, we're going to bring on a guest who kind of crosses different lines. And I think tonight we've accomplished that. Tonight we have Beverly Gooden, who's an author and writer who wrote a book recently called Surviving: Why We Stay and How We Leave Abusive Relationships. And when the topic was first recommended to us, you know, we were thinking, well, how does that really fit in? At the end of the day, we're a financial show. But, you know, Beverly's has great insight. And the reason we're anxious to have her on, and you and I deal with this every week with our client base, the number one reason divorces take as long or people take so long to decide is, guess what, Dom? Financial. Right?
And Mike, and you and I deal with it, I don't say every day, but gosh, every week, every month in our practice, where either existing clients are getting divorced or we have a new client that's going through a divorce and they need financial guidance. Often they don't understand what they're looking at. They don't understand what it means, the implications, pre-tax dollars, after-tax dollars, retirement. All of that is from a wealth financial planning perspective. They need help. And that's what you and I think do pretty well, if I can brag about that.
I think we do. And look, we've done one or two shows with attorneys about divorce. It's expensive. It's painful. It's gut-wrenching. So I think tonight's show is kind of the prequel to divorce. You know, all the stuff that leads you to making that one phone call and calling a mediator or an attorney. So we're really anxious to get Beverly's insight tonight.
Terrific.
So we'll be right back after this quick break with Beverly Gooden.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
Are you paying federal taxes on your cash? I work hard for my money that I keep in cash. And for the life of me, I can't imagine why anyone would want to pay federal taxes on their cash. That's why I keep my cash in the Lebenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund, symbol L-E-T-A-X, the tax.
Rates on cash are already so low, why pay federal taxes on the interest your cash earns? Remember, it's not what you earn, it's what you keep. The Lebenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund, L-E-T-A-X, may help you earn more on the cash you've worked hard for and keep more after-tax dollars in your pocket. Find out more about the fund by speaking with a Lebenthal Global Advisors private wealth advisor or its sponsor at dcmadvisors.com.
For your hard-earned cash, why pay the tax when there's the tax?
Lebenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund. It's not what you make, it's what you keep.
Before investing, you should carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. This and other information is in the prospectus, a copy of which may be obtained by calling 800-441-7031. Please read the prospectus carefully before you invest. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. There is no guarantee that this or any investing strategy will be successful. An investor should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund carefully before investing. The fund is distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC, member FINRA. The fund may invest in municipal securities, the interest on which may be subject to federal alternative minimum tax. After the fund buys a security, the IRS may determine that a bond issued as tax-exempt should in fact be taxable. There is no affiliation between DCM Advisors, LLC, and Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC. DCM Advisors and Ultimus Fund Distributors are not affiliated with Lebenthal Financial Services, Inc., or Lebenthal Global Advisors, LLC.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to the Lebenthal Report. If you're listening to the show live, join in on our discussion with questions or comments at 1-866-472-5790. Again, that's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to contact@lebenthal.com. Now, back to the Lebenthal Report.
All right, I'm Michael Hartzman, back with Dominic Tavella, and our guest this evening, Beverly Gooden, the author and writer of Surviving, Why We Stay and How We Leave Abusive Relationships. Good evening, Bev. How are you?
I'm good. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. Welcome, Beverly.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate that.
So, Beverly, I know this is, you know, this is a tough topic, and I'm sure emotionally it was difficult, or maybe not. Maybe it was cathartic for you to write this book. So why don't you give us kind of, you know, your backstory, if you can, and, you know, what led you to, you know, take on such a tough topic?
Yeah, so I am from Cleveland, Ohio. So I'm a Midwesterner and from a really close family, My parents are pretty religious, and I was raised, you know, in, I would say, in a sheltered environment, though it wasn't, you know, we weren't wealthy or anything, but it was just sheltered. You know, there are a lot of protections in place. And then I got to college. And, you know, when you get to college, everything changes, but particularly the way that you experience relationships when you don't have your parents there anymore to look out for you. And so I met a guy who I would go on to marry a little bit later. But when we started dating, everything was fine. You know, and I know you guys probably hear this a lot. Like, everything was normal. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary. You know, he was a great guy. He was a great guy for a really long time, probably about 7-8 months. And then one night he threw me a birthday party, and it was my birthday. And he was angry at me for something that happened during the party. He thought I was flirting with someone or something like that. And he threw me up against the wall and he started to strangle me for the very first time. It had never happened before. Nothing like that had ever happened before in my life. And so when he finally let me go, I didn't think that I should run. You know, I really didn't even think I was in danger, because for a long time he was great, you know? And so I thought that this was an anomaly, thought this was unusual and that I could fix it. And so that's what I intended to do. And I tried to do that for a few years. And then I realized that that wasn't going to work, that it wasn't something I could even control, that it was abuse and that's what he was doing. And so from there on, it was a journey of trying to get my life in order and get my life back. And that definitely included finances. When I was married to him, I didn't have anything of my own. So I didn't have my own bank account or credit cards. I didn't have my own car. I didn't have a job anymore. I didn't have income. And so I was 100% dependent on him for everything. So, you know, money, food, shelter, all of that. And so that made it really difficult to leave. And I think that's something I talk about a lot with people about surviving abuse, is that the number one reason people stay is because of resources, and specifically the lack of access to resources. If you think about just what it takes to move, you have your application fee, you have your security deposit, you have to pay a deposit sometimes to get electricity or gas, things like that. If you don't have a car, you got to figure out buses or buying a car, or, you know, there are so many things that you have to think about. If you don't have that, or if you don't have access to those resources, it is impossible to get away. And that's a reason why I stayed for so long. And that's a reason why a lot of victims will stay in an abusive relationship.
Bev, I just want to jump on something that you said earlier. And so this idea that control, I think that's a really key word here, yeah. Control of the information that the spouse lets you in on, shares with you, yeah. Makes you aware of, that's part of the control, isn't it? That if it they is. Can keep you isolated, that means right. They also get to control you during mm-hmm. that process.
It's all about control. Some of the experts will say that abuse itself is about power and control. And it's because the person who is abusive wants control over you, but they also want a say, and the final say really, in every decision that you make and every decision that you make together. So the goal is to get you to give up your autonomy completely, so that you are dependent on them and that their control becomes your normal.
Beverly, we deal with clients getting divorced all the time. And the thing that's always eye-opening, I think, for our clients is exactly how long it takes from start to finish. And I think sometimes even though they're a client's attorney does them a disservice, because getting a qualified domestic relation order to split a retirement account, that could take years. It could sit on a judge's desk for years. So the you're dealing with all the stuff that goes on to the before you even get to the divorce part. So this whole process easily could take 3 to 5 years, can it not?
Easily. I mean, just to get divorced took me a year. So I was married a year after I even left. And that was just simply going through the process. So, you know, you have to file a divorce fee. It's just so, you know, it's like a few $100. If you don't have that, you know, what do you do? Filing that fee, then there's a waiting period for, you know, just in case you change your mind, you get back together. You have to wait that out. And then, you know, you have to get a court date, and then you have to wait for that court date. And then, God forbid, you know, some paperwork is not correct somewhere, then there's more waiting. And so, like, just, I mean, to your point, like the prep work to even like get the wherewithal and like the strength to leave is just one step. Then you actually leave and there's all this stuff that is coming towards you that you have to wait for and afford and a lot. It's a lot.
So Bev, to that point, if you're not aware of what your financial resources are, yeah. And you're sitting in this relationship that is clearly unhealthy. Yeah. You don't have resources to leave. This is where many stay, right? Even though they want to leave,
that's right.
They stay. That's right. And so maybe we could address that a
that's
little
right.
bit.
Yeah, so I always think of it like this. So in my day-to-day life where I'm not being abused, I'm fine now, nothing's going on, I have to pay for everything. And those costs rise, depending on what's going on in the economy, what's going on in the markets. Those costs vary from month to month. And so I remember being in my marriage and I didn't know how much money we had from day to day. I didn't have insight into how we were going to get groceries or how much gas costed or, what he made. I didn't even know what he made. And so if I wanted to use some of the money that we had as a couple, which was really his money, if I wanted to use any of that money to escape, I couldn't because I didn't know what we had. And that's a story of a lot of people who are experiencing abuse or have survived abuse. You don't know what you have financially, or you do know and you can't access it to get away. And people will stay in relationships that are violent for years and for decades. Our parents, people that we know from work will stay in these relationships solely because they can't figure out the finances and they can't figure out the resources that are necessary to get out, because it does take resources. When I left, I didn't have anything. I had to get a temporary job so that I could afford to rent a room in a boarding house so that I could have somewhere to sleep. Then I had to spend money on buying a car because I told you I didn't have a car. It was everything I left was with him. I had to buy a car. That was money, Then I had to figure out food. Thank goodness there were like food banks back then that had, a good stock of stuff. But like, imagine if there wasn't. Imagine if I was in a rural area and there was nothing nearby. There are so many complexities when it comes to staying in these relationships, but knowing what kind of money is there or having access to that money is a big reason.
Beverly, you mentioned in the state you were in. If I may ask, what state were you in when you
Texas.
started this? You were in Texas. Okay. So I'm assuming, there are common law states and there are states where assets are split differently. So are there resources in each state where someone could go to? He's raised an interesting point. It's almost a catch 22. If you don't have the money file, then where do you even begin?
What do you do? Yeah. There are, specifically for domestic violence survivors, there are victims advocates that you can find at, I don't want to say any local shelter, but most local shelters will have them. If not, you can call the domestic violence hotline and they can direct you to a shelter that had or an agency that has those resources. In Texas, I don't know if there were any common law. This was 2010, so it was a while ago, but we were only married for 2 years total. And so I don't know that it wouldn't have qualified me for Social Security. I learned that pretty quickly, but I don't know that it would have even qualified me for half of what he had. It was just such a short marriage and I left. So I'm not sure about that, but there are definitely resources out there. I always say go straight to a domestic violence agency website. They have the most resources available for people experiencing abuse, and that could be found there, but I don't remember that from when I left.
So, again, both myself and Michael have dealt with, and in some cases are actually dealing with it as we speak, where we have a spouse that wants to leave. They don't even know what they're entitled to, right? So we have this escape. I need to get out. I don't have any resources. So a domestic violence hotline might be a good place
So
to
good.
start. But understanding what it is that you're entitled to, I think helps you get the courage, right, to maybe make that leap. And that's where perhaps in our case, as financial advisors, somebody comes to
For
us
sure.
or they go to a local attorney. There are a lot of free resources out there that at least can give you some guidance, right, some education as to what you're entitled to. And I think you have to reach out as a victim. You have to reach out, and that take itself takes courage, right?
It does, and it's hard. I mean, sometimes it can be really embarrassing to admit, that you're being abused or that you don't have money, or that you don't know what kind of money you have. I find that like money and relationships, those are two things that are super sensitive. I know you all know about it. I'm preaching to the choir, but like those are two things that are really sensitive in that when something's going wrong, you don't really talk about it, or you don't want to talk about it. It's just kind of like happening in the background. But, it can be really embarrassing when you don't know what you don't know, or when you're experiencing abuse. And those are two reasons why it can be so hard to ask for help in the first place. I love hotlines. I love anonymous hotlines specifically because you can get help without having to give up a lot of information. They're not all like that. Some of them want to know who you are. But I like those because it offers like an opportunity to express your concerns about whatever it is without judgment or without fear that, and this is big, that your abuser will find out what you're doing. They'll find out that you're looking into the money, or they'll find out that you're trying to get away, because that puts you in more danger. And that's something that a lot of people don't know. As soon as an abuser will find out that you're digging around or snooping around, then that puts you in more danger. And that makes it even more unlikely that you're going to leave. You're trapped.
So to that point, you mentioned in when you first reached this conclusion that you had to get out of this marriage, that everything was in your husband's name. So the investment accounts that you guys had, they were not joint, they were in his name solely.
So we didn't have any of those. We were like fresh out of college. And we didn't
even the savings so account was just in his name?
Yeah, the savings account was in his name. The checking account was in both of our names, but I was afraid to spend any money because he would know.
So you would look at it. So we deal with it. This is what we deal with all of the time. Where a client will call us up and say, look, I'm going to go through a divorce, or I'm going through a divorce now. And they have this joint account and they say to me or say to Dom, well, I'm getting divorced, just send me half the money of my joint account. I'm like, well, I could send you half the money, but it's going to both of you, right? Mm-hmm. Both of your names are going to be on the account because it's a joint account. I just can't make a unilateral decision, or you can't make, as the client, a unilateral decision that you just want half the money. So that is where Dominic and I sometimes are kind of, you know, caught between a rock and a hard place. We want to help everyone, but we're very limited to what we can do when there's joint ownership as well.
Yeah, I wonder. I always think back to that time. I think about my financial literacy level, you know, I just didn't know things, you know, and I really wish that I would have had my own individual checking account and put money in it. It just wasn't something that crossed my mind because I'm like, okay, he's my husband, he'll take care of it. You know, it'll be fine. I don't have to worry about what's going on in the bank. And I should have been worried about what was going on in the bank. I don't know. I think, you know, people talk about financial literacy all the time, and I think it's really important, but just like awareness, knowledge that, you know, an individual bank account is a good idea, because many people don't know that you'll have to split the money that's in a joint account. I didn't know that until you said it, you know, I didn't know. I didn't try to go after it at all. But like, I mean, my escape from abuse would have looked so much different had I had my own stuff, you know, and I just didn't. And a lot of survivors just don't. We just don't have our own stuff. But some of that, I do want to say that some of that is not of our own choosing. Financial abuse, we were talking before we came on, financial abuse, what a lot of people don't know is that that is actually the most common form of abuse. And so financial abuse is when someone, specifically a partner, uses money or other financial resources to control their partner. And so, you know, that can look like asking your partner to stop working so that they don't have income, or running up your partner's credit card so they don't have access to credit if they need to get away. And so the whole goal of financial abuse itself is to have power over a partner and create a dependency. And you all know that dependency makes it harder for the abused partner to leave the relationship. And so it's one of the things I'm really passionate about, only because I stayed in my marriage for so long because I didn't have access to resources and didn't know that I should have access to resources. And, you know, like I said, it's the number one reason why people stay in abusive relationships is finances.
And knowledge. Knowledge is power, right? So obviously you need the resource, you need the money so you can rent an apartment. But I've sat down with many a client who's getting divorced and go, well, the law says you're entitled to X, Y, and Z. And they're like, I didn't even know that existed. I didn't know those accounts existed. What do you mean I'm entitled to half his pension, right? What do you mean I'm entitled to part of his Social Security? Again, a lot of this depends on age, right? And it's not knowledge. Knowledge is power. Yeah. So whether it's dealing with somebody, whether it's an 800 number, whether it's dealing with a financial advisor who's willing to donate their time. And there are a lot of resources out there. You have to become knowledgeable. And I keep stressing how many times I've sat down with, and again, Mike, jump in, because I'm sure you've gone through the same thing, where we try to ascertain where that person's financial place is, and they don't even know the answers to the questions, right?
I wouldn't have, honestly, I wouldn't have known.
Yeah, we've had many, many clients where we'll ask them, like you said, you know, what is in your spouse's 401k? Or how much equity do you have in your home? What is the mortgage on your home? And not even people who are going through an abusive relationship. It's just people in general.
Normally,
they let one partner drive the bus. And it's not necessarily the woman who's not, you know, educated. It's just how relationships fall into place.
Yeah.
One person just takes control.
It's true.
I guess what you were saying, Bev, is a male in the relationship who has these types of tendencies, I guess, would be more inclined to take control. Is that the point?
It could be anyone. It could be a male or a female, non-binary, anyone who wants that control, anyone who, because I know sometimes in relationships, I've been in a relationship like this, you'll say, oh, you're better with money, or you're the one, you know, that is better with handling.
And that is
bills.
True, Bev. But it's not always the man. In fact, I would argue that it's a 50-50 split where I've certainly had couples in my office and the man goes, I'm just not interested in that stuff. I don't want to deal with the checkbook. I let her handle it. Right. So it's not always the male or the female that's the one getting abused. In fact, you threw out a stat about the number of men that get abused in relationships.
Yeah, so it's 1 in 4 women and 1 in 7 men. And so abuse is definitely not something that's gender specific. You know, I always say that anyone, regardless of gender, identity, or race, or socioeconomic status, can and does experience abuse. And so the abuser can also be anyone. It's not always a man. It can be the person who is looking for the power and control over the person that they're dating. That is the problem. The control, as you alluded to earlier, the control is the problem. And so that can be anybody. The problem with the controlling is that we want our partners to be who they are. We want them to feel free to, you know, be the person they are. We want them to have autonomy. We want them to be able to say, no, I don't like that. You know, in abuse, you don't get that. You know, whatever partner's being abusive is the one who is saying, you don't get to say, or you don't get to look at the finances. You know, you don't get a debit card. I've heard that so many times. Like, an abused partner is not allowed access to the debit cards or credit cards, not because their name's not on it, but because their abuser is preventing it. They're telling them you can't have it, and, you know, being physically violent if they try to get it. You know, so there are those situations too.
And are there, I know you said in your relationship there were no red flags, but, you know, Dominic and I have been in meetings where you could just see one spouse just being obnoxious, you know, to another, you know, calling them an idiot or stupid or, you know, just uneducated. And I would think that, you know, that also, that type of behavior, if they're doing it in public, sometimes I say to myself, geez, they're talking like that in front of me, you know, Lord knows what's being
said. Who knows
said
what's happening at home?
When they go home.
Worse,
but Beverly, so
for sure.
To Mike's point, when we say abuse, it's not always physical or just physical abuse. It's verbal abuse.
It's verbal abuse.
I think maybe if we could talk a little bit about that. So people watching this going, wow, I didn't realize that's me. That's what's going on in my world.
You know, I'm so glad you said that. There are so many types of abuse. The main ones that are talked about are physical, but there's also verbal. And that can look like name calling, like derogatory language, not like baby, you know, not like cute names, not names that you like, names that are intended to be insults. They're targeting your self-worth, that kind of name calling, making threats, like just threats, like if you do that, I'll hit you, or if you do, and even if they never do, or, you know, you're so stupid, you know, or things like that, you know, just saying things like that. Those are examples of verbal abuse. There's also psychological abuse, and that is, intimidation or coercion, saying, if you love me, if you really love me, you will sign this over, or you will wear this. It's bullying, it's humiliation, it's gaslighting, it's all of those things, specifically the silent treatment, not like I'm silent and, I'm pulling myself together to have a conversation with you later. The silent treatment as in stonewalling, where like this is a tactic that I'm using to make you feel bad and to get you to come to do what I want you to do. That's a manipulation tactic. So all of those are considered abuse. And I think a lot of people don't even know that they're existing in a relationship. They may think it's toxic, but they don't know that there is an element of abuse. And I wish we talked about that more. I think physical happened for me. Psychological happened later. So there was an element of it, but physical was for me. But I've met so many people who have experienced the other types of abuse, financial abuse, psychological, verbal, emotional abuse. Those things count.
So to your point, physical abuse is unfortunately or fortunately easy to prove. There's black and blue marks, there's bruises, there's injuries.
Yeah.
Does the courts in different states make it difficult for the victim of abuse, which is more psychological, to prove that they're, how do you prove it? I mean, how do you prove this in order to get out of a relationship equitably?
I think in terms of the courts like evidence in the form of like physical violence. Like it's going to be really hard to win a case on verbal abuse, unless there is evidence, so you have recorded your partner verbally abusing you, or there are social media posts. Social media is a good tool for law enforcement to use to find whatever they want, right? So if they can see your partner abusing you, verbally or psychologically or technologically, that's another form of abuse, technological abuse. So trackers on your phones and stuff. If they can see that, if that can be proven, then you can take it to court and, whatever your end goal is, a restraining order, whatever it is, you can probably get that. But to your point, the courts like evidence. And so it's really, I didn't access the courts. I didn't go to court until I was ready to get divorced. So I didn't have the experience of trying to get a restraining order or things like that. It can be really hard, but I do know that it requires some measure of proof that it happened. And that is most of the time impossible in the case of verbal abuse and psychological abuse. You don't really have that. And so it's hard. The laws don't make it easy for survivors. I know you probably have heard a lot recently or the last few years about, the Violence Against Women's Act being renewed and, how that's been stalled a million times and, how there are explicitly more protections and expanding the definition of abuse from someone who lives in your home to someone maybe not in your home who is still being abusive. So the laws have a long way to go and they're slowly getting there. But as of today, you really do need evidence.
I think one of the things that I always focus on when a new client's coming in is the just lack of knowledge. And I think what makes it very difficult for somebody like us is that every state is different. So we happen to be located in New York and the law here is pretty clear. But again, you mentioned Florida, you mentioned Texas. Mm-hmm. Those laws are different. So in some states it's an equal, everything is divided equally, whether they want to or not. In other states, it's not quite that cut and dry. So understanding those laws makes it hard for people like us to try to give them good advice. So where do we start? Where do we start with trying to, hey, you know what? This is your first step to getting your freedom.
That is a really good question. I think, the first steps for me, in my opinion, involve other people, family members, friends, encouraging family members and friends can you open this person a safety deposit box? Can you open a PO box for them? Or can you get them a storage unit? Then you can start moving documents. You know, you see where I'm going?
Like,
then you
can start, I love that answer. Yeah. I love that answer, including can you open a bank account for me? Ask a brother, a sister, a parent.
Yes.
Can you open a bank account? And I don't care if you put $50 a week in it, start creating that safe fund.
That's what it is. Like, can you add me as an authorized user to your credit card? Now, that's complicated. A lot of people don't like to do it, but maybe you don't get a card and you're just benefiting from their card uses. I don't know. That one's a little complicated, but the safety deposit box, easy. PO box, easy. And the point is to begin building your freedom, not just your financial freedom, but your freedom period. I opened a storage unit when I was getting ready to leave, and I started to make copies of all my documentation, every single piece of it, and I would put it in that storage unit because I knew I wouldn't be able to get to it once I left the house. And so I think for us, like, encouraging people to take those initial steps that don't have anything to do, you know, maybe it doesn't seem like that it has anything to do with, like, dollar for dollar, like, every day, but it will, you know. So I think, like, to your point, it's like building that safe place for you to go and also for your money to go in the future is critical. And I think it's one of those small steps that can be easily overlooked. You know, we can say like, go and open up your own bank account, but that takes documentation. You know, like, you can't just go walk in and say, give me a bank account. You know, you have to, like, prove your identity and prove, you know, all these things. And so it's like, if you leave and you don't have access to that, you have a more difficult time doing basic things like opening accounts. Why not start early with your PO box or your safety deposit box, or that was my blind, or your safety deposit box or whatever, where you know you will have copies of your documentation. That's how I think about it strategically.
Bev, the one account that is always in an individual's name, always, is a retirement account.
That's good to
know. So, you know, you're a relatively young woman. So maybe when you got your first job, you weren't thinking about your 401k. You weren't thinking about 40 years in advance.
No.
But wouldn't you agree that if you have any suspicion at all, the easiest thing to do would be to start a retirement account? I mean, get the money back out prematurely may involve penalties and taxes. But at least you're in control of it, and you have access to it.
I totally agree. Anything that you can be in control of, whether big or small, is really important. And like you said, like, there's a penalty if you withdraw early, but at least it's yours to withdraw, and no one else can do that. I think that's brilliant.
And a 401k you could borrow against without anyone else's permission, and that's without any taxable events.
Wow. Wow.
So, Dom, those are just two things I'm thinking of off the top of my head, if you could think of anything.
That's amazing.
Look, I'm going to come back to my personal experience again, and I don't want to speak for Mike, but I guarantee it's the same thing, where many of the, I'll say the majority are women statistically. They're a friend. One of our clients says, I need you to speak to one of my friends. She's going through something right now and she could use some guidance. So I thought your advice of reaching out to your friends, your family, your brothers, sisters, and asking for resources. Mm-hmm. Myself and Michael have sat down with many a person for free. There's no charge, just to give them advice and guidance. And that includes Mike. Yeah, take advantage of your 401k at work. You start building your own little nest egg. Hey, you can open an account on your own. This is the documentation you need. These are what your legal rights are in this state. There are a lot of advocacy groups out there that will provide you that knowledge and information. But you have to take those steps, right? That's courage. It takes a lot of courage to do that.
It does. And courage can be really hard, especially when you have, like, fear involved, you know, and you have threats involved. But nothing happens without that courage. I would still be married, you know, without that courage. And, you know, I don't like to pretend like it was easy. The journey was really hard. Nothing about it was easy, and it was terrible for a long time. But I'm fine now. And I think that, you know, it takes time. But with that courage, with that planning, I'm big on, like, planning and strategy in any context. With that courage, with that planning, with that help from your friends and family and people who love you, it can be done. It can be done.
So Bev, what encouraged you to write the book?
Yeah. So, okay, the interesting thing is I never wanted to. Like, I've never intended to write about this situation. You know, I survived it. I went back to grad school. I finished my master's degree. My thesis was on domestic violence, and I felt like that was going to be my contribution to the domestic violence space. And then I was done, and then I was moving on to something else. And then a few years ago, not even a few years ago, 2014, oh my goodness, that feels like a few years ago, 2014, a video came out of Ray Rice. He was a football player, and he had punched his fiance in an elevator and dragged her out. And so I remember that video being released, and everyone was, you know, having sympathy for her. But as soon as they found out that she was married to him, after that happened, it turned on her. It became, why would she stay with him? And so the book, it builds off of that moment. In that moment, I felt a lot of shame, you know, because I knew I had a similar story of abuse. I was abused. I married my abuser after it started. I felt that the target was me, and it wasn't. And since that day, I've been talking about my experience, trying to convince people that, you know, staying is complicated, that abuse is difficult, and there are so many factors going into those decisions. And that's why I wrote the book. I wanted to write a book that spoke specifically about staying, because I think it's a choice that people make, and sometimes it's the best choice they can make in that moment that keeps them alive while they plan, while they try to get out. I write about my own personal story of abuse, and then I also write about life after abuse. I feel like a lot of times we have books or movies about abuse, and it's just all trauma, and it's just all sadness. And, you know, and it should be, you know, because abuse is bad. But also, I wanted to write a story, and I want to see stories and hear stories about people who are fine now, who made it out, who are happy, who rebuilt their lives, you know, who, I want to see that. And so that's why I wrote that, because I want people to know that I'm okay and that they can be okay in the end.
It's a hard thing to see. And again, in full disclosure, I'm literally going through it with a client as we speak. And when you're in the middle of that cloud, and that's the way I describe it, it really is difficult to see past it and see that there is a better future, right? It's hard. And so one of the comments I'm constantly having is, this is how you feel today, but a year from now, your world's going to be completely different, hopefully completely better.
I love it.
But in that moment, even if you can see the financial picture may not be so horrific, that you're experiencing that and the embarrassment and dealing with family and friends, it's an incredibly cloudy picture. To get through that cloud is very, very difficult. Got to be fair to the victims here.
Yeah, it's really difficult.
And yourself, because you went through it.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, I don't know. I like guarantees, right? Like, I like to know that things are going to be okay. When you're leaving abuse, you don't know that. You're walking into the unknown alone without your partner. It's scary. It's traumatic. It's hard. The way that I got through it emotionally specifically was by reminding myself that it could be better, you know? And that's kind of similar to what you said. What will happen a year from now? Where will you be? I constantly remind myself that it could be better than this. You know, like, this is not great. I mean, my life could look differently. What do I have to do to get there? That's what kept me going. That's what gave me courage. Wanting to see my nephews grow up, that gave me courage. So I think it's just identifying those things that you love, that you hope for, that you want to see in the future will help you think from this moment to the next moment. I want to see my nephews grow up. I can't do that here because I'm going to die in this marriage or I'm going to die in this relationship. So what do I do to make sure that happens?
You know, and I'm sure it was very difficult for you to reach that point, and it was difficult for you to break through and write the book. So I'm sure, you know, people are grateful who get a chance to read it and experience it. And just before we go, just one more time, what would be the resources for anyone to reach out to? Is there anyone in any one agency in particular that's nationwide, or?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There are a few agencies that I'm thinking of. Obviously, the National Domestic Violence Hotline. They also have a text chat, so you don't even have to call. You can just text. I would say be careful about texting if you're in a relationship that's abusive. especially if your partner monitors your phone. So that's also a risk, but the phone call is there. There's an organization called Love is Respect, and that is focused on teens. And teenagers start dating and they start experiencing abuse. And so I think it's important for us adults to know, you know, that the young people in our lives are also going through it. And if they need help, Love is Respect is an organization for that. There's an organization that focuses on male survivors of sexual abuse, I think, and it's called 1 in 6, because that's a statistic. And I think the website is 1in6.org. And if you are a man, identify as a man, you can go to that website and get help with that. Those are the ones that I would want to point out. The one for everybody, the one for teenagers, and the one for men.
Terrific. Thank you.
So Beverly, we appreciate having you on. I know this is difficult material, and congratulations on making it through the other side of this difficult journey.
I really appreciate being on. Thank you for allowing me.
Your future success.
Oh, thank you. And look, I appreciate it, guys.
We got to ask, where could people get your book? Where
is it available?
Hold it up.
Because Lissa will have my head.
So my book is called Surviving: Why We Stay and How We Leave Abusive Relationships, and it can be found wherever books are sold. My name is Beverly Gooden, and my website is beverlygooden.com. Last name is spelled G-O-O-D-E-N.
Thank you, Beverly. So now
we're
all off the hook with Lissa, because we had our heads if we didn't do that.
And I hope we at least stirred people to consider their situation, your levels of abuse, right? So at least consider their situation and maybe do a little planning for their future.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you so much, you all.
Thank you. Evening. Stay safe.
Have a good one.
We'll be right back right after this break.
When you're thinking about where to park your cash, for over 30 years in the business, I've been a fan of funds like the Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund. It's managed for cash and designed so the interest income you receive is free from federal taxes. And who doesn't love paying less taxes?
Mike, generating interest that's free from federal taxes is appealing, but I've been in this business for a long time, and people love the potential for more income on their hard-earned cash.
Sorry, Dom. But the beauty of the funds is paying less taxes on cash.
No, my friend, it's the potential for more income.
Mm-mm. Less taxes.
More income.
Less taxes.
More income.
Less for taxes. Your cash. More income. Ask your advisor about the Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund.
Less taxes.
Or find out more at dcmadvisors.com.
Well, Dom, one thing I know we agree on, it's not what you earn.
It's what you keep.
Labenthal Ultra Short Tax-Free Income Fund. Symbol LETAX. LETAX.
Before investing, you should carefully consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. This and other information is in the prospectus, a copy of which may be obtained by calling 800-441-7031. Please read the prospectus carefully before you invest. Investing involves risk, including loss of principal. There is no guarantee that this or any investing strategy will be successful. An investor should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the fund carefully before investing. The fund is distributed by Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC, member FINRA. The fund may invest in municipal securities, the interest on which may be subject to federal alternative minimum tax. After the fund buys a security, the IRS may determine that a bond issued as tax-exempt should in fact be taxable. There is no affiliation between DCM Advisors, LLC, and Ultimus Fund Distributors, LLC. DCM Advisors and Ultimus Fund Distributors are not affiliated with Labenthal Financial Services, Inc. or Labenthal Global Advisors, LLC.
You are listening to the Labenthal Report. If you're listening to the show live, join in on our discussion with questions or comments at 1-866-472-5790. Again, that's 1-866-472-5790. You may also send an email to contact@labenthal.com. Now, back to the Labenthal Report.
All right, I'm Michael Hartzman, back with Dominic Tavella for a quick wrap-up. And you know what, Dom? I'm glad we had Beverly on. It was a tough topic, and I really think, you know, she handled her journey as gracefully as she possibly can.
My God, what a magnificent young woman, bright, intelligent, vibrant, that I think hopefully her book helps a lot of people. And you are right, Mike, it's a difficult subject and we deal with it pretty regularly in our practice. And it's just kid gloves. You got to be very careful and very sensitive to people's emotions because they drive everything. Yeah, it's typically not financial decisions, they're emotional decisions.
And you know what? Look, we hear about divorce all the time, but it's rare that we'll get a client that will admit to us that they've been in an abusive relationship, unless it's a new client who doesn't have a history with us. But, you know, even if we have an existing client, they may tell us they're getting divorced, but it's very rare that they will give us a peek behind that curtain because of the embarrassment or whatever that they've had to deal with for years.
And Mike, as Beverly said, there are different kinds of abuse, not always physical. And I think when you and I sit there and we ask, I call the dumb questions, the probing questions, you understand what's really going on in that relationship. And we'd like to get them out as quickly as possible. But you hinted at it. These things can take a very, very long time to resolve themselves and sometimes go through very ugly court battles. So it needs to be handled very, very carefully and with kid gloves.
Yeah, no, Dom, years was not an exaggeration. And Beverly is right. You need the resources to get through that initial drought financially, because that's what it could be, a financial drought.
And if we could leave people one single thought, and Beverly hit the nail on the head, look for resources, talk to friends, talk to family, tell them what's going on in your world and ask for help. And whether it's setting up a bank account or talking to a wealth advisor like you or I to give them some guidance. There are a lot of 800 numbers out there. There's not a lot of non-for-profits out there that are willing to give guidance. Look for resources.
You're right. Dom, unfortunately, we're out of time, but I think we did some good tonight. Okay. I'm happy we did this show, and I will see you next week.
Looking forward to it, Mike. Thank you.
And have a good night, everybody. We'll see you down the road.
Thanks for tuning in to the Labenthal Report. Dominic Tavella and Michael Hartzman will be back for our next program, airing next Tuesday at 2 p.m. Pacific Time and 5 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Until then, have a great week. The following program is being brought to you on